Bear on Bears fans, another edition of the Chicago Bears podcast coming your way. Pat the Designer, Courtney Cronin here for another Thursday, and we got a lot to get into on today's episode. I mean, listen, Courtney Cronin has all the best stories about Caleb Williams apparently available. So we got to dive into this article that we got to read and kind of see how she got some of these stories. What were her observations from some of the stories about the Chicago Bears new quarterback? And listen, it seems like this stadium thing is a lot more difficult than Kevin Warren may be making it seem. I don't know if we're going back to Arlington or not, but where are we playing and where are we parking? All that and more in today's episode of the Chicago Bears podcast. Hit that like button, subscribe to the page, leave a 5-star review. Y'all know what to do. Courtney, what's going on?
Not much. I'm still trying to figure out the answer to your last question too. And when Ryan Poles was on Pat McAfee yesterday, I think that was one of the final things he was asked when he was asked about the stadium, which obviously he would have no answer to give publicly. Yeah. And, he was asked, like, well, where are people parking? And he's like, yeah, I don't know.
I don't know that either.
I don't know the answer to that. That one truly is above his pay grade because they have not released anything in the renderings for Chicago that would show you where cars are. And then, of course, I know we'll get into it, but we hear that the governor of Illinois calls this project a non-starter. So back to square one, I guess.
Yeah, I have no idea. I mean, the stadium situation right now is the most confusing thing around Chicago. Who would have thought the stadium would be more confusing than the team? Like, we've watched this team our entire lives. Who would have ever thought, like, the team makes perfect sense. I see all the paths to success. I can see us developing a quarterback. How are we going to get this building put up? We have no idea. We have no money. We're poor, apparently. And we have no money, and we have no options to build this thing. But I don't know. I can't even start there because that's going to take us into a tangent. Let's start in a little bit more positive place. Let's start the podcast off right, because you wrote a very, very good article on, I believe this came out on Tuesday, mm-hmm. And been kind of waiting to get you back on here to break it down. Sitting here looking at different stories of Caleb Williams that told by the people who know him and that kind of tell you the kind of person that he is and different things like that. The one that really, really stood out to me was him crashing the 6 a.m. club. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was reading through this, you see that Caleb Williams is just, I don't know, like, what was your takeaway from this? What was your takeaway from this story in all, like when you hear about what kind of went on here?
Yeah, and I went into this hoping to find the stories that show how unique of a person, of a prospect, of a player he is, and not just the stuff that you see on the field. Like, we've seen him take over in that Red River rivalry game, which of course is a huge part of his football journey, but yeah. That is something that we all got to see on TV. We got to see the Heisman Trophy moments during his 22 season at UCLA or at USC when, you know, I think it's the big run against UCLA there at the end of the season. Then, of course, what happens against Notre Dame in a nationally televised game and then the Pac-12 championship. He rips off this run and pops his hamstring in the process. But right. Like all of those things we've already seen. I went into this hoping to find more about what makes him tick as a person, kind of his makeup, and who he is away from the field. Like, stuff that obviously, like, correlates to the field because everybody I talked to has had some connection with him through football. But I wanted to learn more about the makeup of this kid from a 16-year-old kid to a 22-year-old young adult. And what I came away with were some really cool anecdotes. Like, a lot hit the cutting room floor just because, for sake of space and clarity and trying to get, you know, one from each person I talked to in there, it was difficult to whittle it down because there were some really cool stories. But the one about the 6 a.m. club at Oklahoma, it shows his competitive fire. And it's something that I feel like over the last couple of days in talking with Lincoln Riley after Caleb was introduced on Friday, in hearing from Ryan Poles, how he's seen it. Remember last week he was asked about Caleb Williams and his big goals. And he's like, I love it. We should all have big goals. Yeah. All of those things showed up with a story like this. So legend goes, or legend, according to Chip Viney, who was the director of player development at Oklahoma at the time. So he was in a personnel role. He's now the cornerbacks coach at Arizona. He's coached against Caleb at San Jose State as the cornerbacks coach. But this story really stood out to me because this was a freshman who was a highly touted freshman, a freshman that was a five-star recruit who ended up enrolling in classes early at, you know, going into his freshman year at Oklahoma while still completing his high school requirements to get his diploma, because they wouldn't let him graduate early to go enroll at Oklahoma. Some schools are different about that, but he was doing like a two loads of coursework, and then gets to Oklahoma and is not the starter right away. So there's one day early that season where Chip Viney is walking into his office, and it's really early in the morning. No one else is there. Like, he doesn't have his glasses or his contacts in, and he sees someone standing outside his door, and he gets closer and he realizes it's Caleb. At that time of morning, it's kind of like, oh no, why is he here? Like, what's wrong is the first inclination there, because you think at that time of morning, and what he says next, which is, hey, I've been wrestling with something all night, I need someone to talk to. He's thinking worst case scenario that, oh my goodness, this guy wants to transfer. He's going to tell me that he's homesick, that it's not the right fit for him, that he made a mistake. And instead, Caleb approaches him with, how can I get in that 6 a.m. workout group? And it was kind of this moment for Chip Viney, who was like, okay, freshman, relax. Like, we need you in your group. I understand your competitive fire and what you want to do here, but we need you leading the freshman. And Caleb positioned himself to, you know, kind of his argument for this is, well, no, I want to be the starter on this team. I want to put myself in position to do that. So I need to, if I want to compete to be the best, I have to go up against the best. And Spencer Rattler is currently in that group, who was the starter at Oklahoma before Caleb got there. And, you know, he started there in 2020 and then was the starter up until that Red River rivalry game where Caleb effectively supplanted him in 2021. But he really wouldn't take no from an answer yeah. from the way that the story was relayed to me, which kind of shows you how from an early time in his college career, that confidence that you saw him speak with at the podium, that you saw him, you've seen him at many different points of his career, especially after all of the accolades came in. That's been consistent throughout his entire career. That was consistent before he was even a starter. And so for him to have the calculated approach of, all right, if I want to be the starter, this is how I have to go about it. And then not taking no for an answer. And legend goes that he left the room, went down to the locker room, changed into his workout clothes, and went and worked out with the 6 a.m. group anyways. And then Benny Wiley, who was the strength and conditioning coach at Oklahoma, then went to USC, but like came upstairs like, yo, wait, why was Caleb in this workout with these upperclassmen? And then it was a whole thing. And then they end up bringing it to Lincoln Riley and they made an exception more or less. And it's not that, you know, they felt that they had to keep him on campus or anything like that, or he was going to threaten to transfer. It was that, okay, no, we see something. This guy's different. Like, we see that he has a real, he's taking this seriously. Most freshmen at that time are just trying to get acclimated, just trying to learn the playbook. Like, he's trying to go be the starter and he feels like he can be the starter. And there was some belief from what I had been told, like in talking with other people around the story or around the circumstances of like around Oklahoma going into this story, some of my reporting, that there were people in the building who kind of felt, okay, this is going to happen sooner rather than later, because they did feel that Caleb was a bigger deal and better than right. Spencer Rattler. And that's kind of a crazy thing to think about, because Spencer Rattler was considered the next one after Jalen Hurts leaves. And we know that they had Kyler Murray there. We had, they had Baker Mayfield. Those are all a part of Lincoln Riley's repertoire of quarterbacks who have won the Heisman, not Hurts, but the other two who he's coached. And Spencer Rattler was supposed to be that next guy. Well, that next guy ended up being Caleb Williams. So they let him then go work out in that 6 a.m. group. And it's kind of like the rest is history, because he ends up supplanting Spencer Rattler. And, you know, the dynamics of that and what it would be like being in a quarterback room that had two well-respected guys, the up-and-comer who was clearly better and somebody who had lost their job but was still respected by the team. I'm sure that wasn't easy for the team to have to navigate, but ultimately – led them to, I believe, a 9 or 10 win season that year in a bowl game. And that's what got Lincoln Riley the job at Oklahoma, or from Oklahoma to USC. And it was interesting hearing that and then following up with Lincoln Riley last week when he talked about his job and his experience in having to harness some of that competitive fire of Caleb Williams, where he goes in starting out as a backup and didn't think that he was above being a backup, but clearly had his sights set on something far bigger than being a backup. So, like, how do you balance that when you don't know the offense yet, like you're not comfortable in it yet, but you also still have really high goals that you want to achieve and you want to dive headfirst into that? And the way that they approach this with him crashing the workout and, you know, being like, hello, I'm here. Like, I'm here, I'm not going anywhere. That's kind of how he's approached a lot of things throughout multiple points of his career. And even when you hear him last week talking about, why would I duck expectations? I'm here. Rome's here. Keenan Allen's here. Like, that's just, it's kind of the way, like, it's neat to see when the same things pop up at various junctures of someone's career, because that's one way to show you, like, how consistent someone has stayed in their actions. And very clearly, that's a story that show that highlights that with Caleb Williams and has throughout his career.
And what I loved about it was, right, like, coaches could have got mad, coach told him no, right? Like, no, you're not supposed to be in this group. Didn't stifle this kid, didn't try to hold him back. And the kid's like, coach may be mad at this, but I'm at least see, right, what boundaries I can push, what I can get away with. And not really like he's trying to get away with it to disrespect somebody. I love how you put in there. None of it was intended as disrespect. It wasn't disrespect to Spencer Rattler. It wasn't disrespect to the coaches. It was, I want to show these guys what I'm really trying to do, and I want to be on the rack next to them. I want to learn as much as I can from them. When you hear stuff like that about them, I mean, like, those are the kind of stories that you just go, like, okay, this guy's got a different level mindset on how I want to be successful. What do I want to do? And nobody's going to stop me from attaining how I want to be successful. I'm going to find a way to do it. I just got to figure out what that is. And so I saw that when that story screamed off the page to me. Was there one that stood out to you from this article that I guess bigger than that one?
I mean, that one I thought kind of like lays the groundwork for learning about who Caleb Williams is. And, you know, that's the competitive edge that we're going to see here in Chicago that he says he's bringing with him, that he wants to stay consistent with. But I thought one that really like kind of hit home for me was, you know, we've seen so much about Caleb Williams, the corporation, more or less, like the guy who's earned millions of dollars in NIL money, somebody who has truly lived a pro lifestyle in a lot of respects of being in the public eye since long before the time he was drafted. But his Heisman Trophy ceremony and the decision to go to New York, he was one of the finalists that was invited, and he wanted to bring his offensive line with him. So what he did was, like, all 5 starters and the backups, so then there were 8 or 9 people there from his offensive line, they all went with to New York on Caleb's dime. And some people will probably ask, well, how can he afford that stuff? He's a college kid. You know, does he just come from money? It was his parents paying for everything. From what I've been told, a lot of that is NIL funds that helped him be able to foot having people over, teammates over at his apartment downtown LA for team bonding events, whether they're watching the Lakers game, eating Wingstop, or like coming over to play video games, and he has brunch there for them. Like, that's just, I remember talking with one of his teammates who's actually coming to the Bears for a camp tryout, John Jackson III. So he played receiver at USC and at Nevada. And he said, you know, like, Caleb would do all these things and like inviting people into his space, like kind of creating these team bonding moments away from the field, where, you know, coaches will always look to the leaders of the team to do that. But Caleb taking that on his own, using his own resources to get that done, I think really speaks to a level of maturity that just doesn't typically, that's just not there with most players, because we're in a different era now where if I have the means, kind of like how it is in the NFL, if you have the means to go take care of your offensive line, you're going to do that for those big Christmas gifts, whether it's buying guys golf bags, wine, whatever it is. He's doing that at the college level. He did that at the college level. So for him to pay for everybody's flights, hotels, organizing dinners when they were out there, and then hearing that speech. Like, I still remember where I was watching that speech in 2021, when he had every offensive lineman in the room that was there for the Heisman Trophy ceremony stand up. He said their names and he gave them a moment to get recognized. Did he have to do that? No. But does it send a really strong message about who he is as a teammate when there have been all these questions about, you know, like we even, like Ryan Poles mentioned it. Jalen Johnson mentioned it. And yeah, Jalen's was kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing, but how Poles talked about it last week with, you know, the Hollywood stuff did come up. And like to be able to talk through that, it's like, no, I'm not thinking I'm above everybody else when I'm coming in. And fair or not, that may, in the eyes of some, have been the perception of Caleb Williams. You can point back to stories like this to be like, oh no, he's legit. Like, he's somebody who cares about somebody other than himself. And I think that can be really difficult for people to understand because we just want to be skeptical and we want to believe, or at least some people really want to believe, like what's out there is true, when it might paint somebody in not a negative light because it makes that person feel more real and not like, wow, how are you such a great football player and such a great teammate one? Like, it's difficult to decipher those things. Like, you know, I really like that story. I heard that from Brett Nealon, who was his starting center at USC in 2022. And just like, you know, after the high, like just showing you, like, he may be this otherworldly athlete and a franchise quarterback and all of the things, the labels that are associated with him and his talent. But this was still somebody who at that time, like, I'm sure every club wanted him there to promote him, even though I think he was underage. Like, doesn't matter. Like, what, you know, all the things in New York that night that he could have been doing. Instead, he was in his hotel room, like ordered room service with his guys, like acting like, you know, like normal, like early 20 somethings where they're just hanging out, you know, having a moment, and he falls asleep next to his Heisman because he's exhausted. Like, that's a cool thing, that a memory that I'm sure for him probably sticks with him heavily, because those are the people who helped get you there. And to recognize those people that helped get you there, I think shows a sort of consciousness about him, that he knows that it's not all about him, despite the fact that he's the one in the spotlight.
So let me ask you this then, right? Because we hear, I love all of these stories. I mean, we could go through all of them, but like, how do we get to the other side? How do we get to all the things we're hearing pre-draft, all of the smear campaigns that we're hearing on this kid? The whole time I'm like, all right, you guys are mad about his fingernails and his mom. But that leads to, right now we got people on major platforms saying, well, he's probably got some poor leadership. I don't know if these guys respect him. I've heard this from this guy, right? Like all these sources that all of a sudden magically have disappeared post-draft. How do we get to the other side when we hear all of these things like this?
You see it play out in the NFL. And you talk to guys about how it's going. And it takes time. It's not like anything you hear, whether it's rookie camp, and these questions will inevitably be asked of veteran players, like, how is Caleb integrating himself into the team? The answer will be some cookie cutter. Oh, he's doing great. Like, he's exactly what we expected him to be. He's shown that he can be a great leader and a great teammate. And we're excited for him as our quarterback. When you'll really see that is when losses happen, as we know. When adversity hits. And there was that whole thing, the tweet exchange with himself coming off of the Greg McElroy podcast appearance, where he's like, what adversity has Caleb Williams faced? And then, you know, Caleb came out and talked about the hamstring injury and certainly what happened last year and like a 7-5 season that ended, you know, not the way that he wanted it to. All of those things, like, he deemed adversity. But what about the adversity in a city like this, where you have been pumped up? And no, to no fault of his own, it's not like he's coming out here saying, I'm the greatest thing ever. It's everybody else. It's the expectations. Yeah. It's his film. It's the fact that this city has never had someone who, like him, like, is on trajectory to go shatter all of the records that seem like a very low threshold, but like have not been done for whatever godforsaken reason before. So it's being able to handle all of that, to still be the guy who's doing the bear claw and yelling bear down into, or go bears into the microphone, and being that same person when things aren't going perfectly, and not turning into somebody who is difficult at that point, difficult as a teammate, difficult to work with, difficult to coach. And that's what the Bears believe that they did within their due diligence of this process of finding out his coachability, his accountability, the level of taking responsibility and ownership when things go wrong. Could he have said last year that my team had no defense, my offensive line was terrible? Sure. And maybe he thinks that privately. You've never heard him say that, though. And the Bears haven't either. Like, that was a big thing for them in checking those boxes. The final, you remember Ryan Pohl said that, you know, it was a top 30 visit. Like, he knew then that that was his guy. He probably knew before that, but like, at least like for him to know dead set, this is the guy. I don't need to bring another quarterback in on a visit. I am convinced that this is the quarterback we're going with. It was learning those other things about his leader that like would tell you effectively about his leadership to be comfortable making him your number one overall pick. And clearly they did. They met that threshold that the Bears needed to have to be deemed acceptable.
No, for sure. And I think the one thing, right, where everybody always talks about him speaking or not speaking, a lack of speaking after games. And that was a big thing as well early on in the whole draft process. Mm-hmm. My thing with that is we can't confuse the sins of the adults with the sins of the students in this situation. Yes, he is a student. Yes, he is a player. Yes, he's still a kid.
And he was also like, that's not always his choice. Like Lincoln Riley.
Exactly. That's my point.
There are media restrictions that a lot of these programs have for their star players where we have to, as NFL people, like kind of take a step back and realize, okay, they don't have the same media requirements that teams do in the NFL. Like if a quarterback doesn't talk after a loss, he better be hurt in the NFL. That's the only way that you get out of that. Otherwise, like it literally is in your contract that you have to be made available, especially a quarterback. But at the college level, I mean, hell, I've had college games that I've covered where the quarterback typically talks, but there have been some examples where it's been such a bad loss that they didn't. And does it look terrible on the program? Yeah. And does it sometimes like get reflected on the athlete, whether that's fair or not? Yeah, it does. But it's just completely different. And I think people need to be cognizant of that when judging, you know, how they viewed Caleb's leadership last year and crying after that Utah game and you know, not speaking after that, you know, a couple of the games too.
That's going to be tough though. The fact that it was Utah and Jalen Johnson said he definitely talks trash about Utah USC. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to lie. The crying's definitely going to come up in the locker
room. Of course it is. Of course it is. The guys I'm sure are going to want to use it as like fodder of like, oh, you want to go cry to your mom now? And you can do what you want with that. I also want to like, put out, it's 2024, like to act like crying is reserved for only one gender is kind of an antiquated way of thinking, but if within the context of a locker room and competition, all those
all
things,
joking aside,
like, I think
joking.
that will probably, unless it's something that's really personal to him and you would make that known if you're Caleb Williams, like that's off limits. Like that was, but if it is something that the guys can poke fun at him about, or at least like rib him about a little bit, I think they'll do it in a way that's like not malicious.
And your hope is that Caleb internalizes it, takes it personally, and then goes out and rips off four touchdowns on the defense. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I mean, it could be a competitive fire for him.
Yeah, I mean, I would absolutely love to see that. I think that a lot of these stories are so awesome and they really open your eyes to who Caleb Williams is. I implore all of you guys to go check out Courtney's article if you haven't done so yet. It's on ESPN.com right now. Tap in with that. Let me ask you this before we get up out of this. What's the story that didn't make the article that you wish you could have put in there?
So there,
you said you had a bunch of.
There was just so many. Like I had 9 interviews and just kind of.
Were you dealing with the Ryan Poles thing where you're like, I'm trying to find somebody that doesn't like this kid?
I mean, you always like try to find, like you try to go about it in a fair and balanced way. And if somebody says something that's, you know, isn't like the most glowing compliment about this guy, you know, I do think that, I mean, one of the things I actually asked Max Brown, who's an analyst, he former USC quarterback who, you know, was part of that. He was a backup. Then he ended up finishing his career, I believe, at Pitt. You know, his biggest knock on Caleb was the, you know, just some of like the little things, like when he painted like FU on his nail going to that Utah game. Okay, well, that kind of bit you. And learning from things like that where it's harnessing that competitive fire and not making it a detriment because, like, you know, there's always going to be the people who outside of the USC program or outside of any program, like if you're not winning or if you – they're going to look at it as like, okay, this guy's a jerk. This guy's a prima donna. And inside the program, it's all right. Are you winning? Are you not? And I asked him about like, does that rub anybody inside USC the wrong way? And he told me no. And he's close to the program because he's an analyst. He played there. And I mean, his biggest criticism, I guess, if you want to even call it a criticism, is that he's curious about Caleb playing out of structure next year and not constantly relying on the hero ball part and, you know, going backyard football. And we know that Ryan Poles has mentioned the ability to like be a surgeon and be an artist. And I think that is going to be a difficult mix for Caleb, because unlike Justin Fields, I think Caleb will get to a point. It won't be probably right away, but you know, there'll be a point for him where he's going to realize, oh, I don't have to go into ISO mode more or less all the time, because I can trust that whether I'm under pressure or whether I'm not under pressure, I can throw the ball to the same spot every time. That's something that Justin struggled with, because he didn't trust what he was seeing. He didn't trust what he was feeling. He had a bad peripheral feel. That's just who he is as a quarterback. And that's unfortunate, but that's reality. Caleb has, like, the processing speed is faster. That's what the Bears believe. And that's why they made this change. And, you know, if you're seeing somebody who can hit every throw from different arm angles and doesn't freeze up in the face of pressure and immediately divert back to just instincts, then that makes a different player. But, you know, I think that there's, you know, that was one of the, I guess you'd call it a concern about, you know, about him, like, in the NFL, like, will he revert to that at all times? Are there ways that he can, like, not have that become like his default mechanism? Because it's not always going to be bad, but you know, there's that. And then I'll say, like, one of the stories that I really wanted to put in there, but like, because of the sake of time or because of like length, Connor McQueen, who I opened up the article with, who kind of, like, I had like a scene setter lead there about how he was at Oklahoma, his first day as an offensive, like, analyst, like basically a GA. Was the day that Caleb went on his visit, and he, you know, didn't even meet Lincoln Riley yet, because Lincoln was with Caleb, and they end up finding out, like, okay, who is this guy? Like, that's like, it was just one of those really cool stories that, you know, was kind of showed the beginning of their relationship. But then he told me the story about when they were at practice, like, his number one duty at practice was to blow plays dead with the whistle, because USC would wear headsets at practice with all the coaches and you know, anybody who was around in a coaching capacity, so they could hear each other. And Lincoln's calling plays at practice, so it was Connor McQueen's responsibility to blow these plays dead. So, like, whenever the defense got a perceived sack, he would have to blow the whistle dead. And he's getting screamed at by these defensive coaches, because he, you know, he has to be a little bit biased, because it's like, I'm sorry, in a game, Caleb would have gotten out of that. You're trying to make it as realistic as possible, where he's, you know, not blowing plays dead probably as much as the defensive staff would have liked. But it's like, sorry, take a look at who your quarterback is. He's going to find a way out of that. And what he did in games, I mean, there was that run that he had against Notre Dame where he, like, it's like second and 13, and he's, you know, he's scanning, steps, you know, looking around, moving in the pocket side to side, steps up, and then does a counterclockwise circle and, like, zigzags through traffic and, like, leaves Notre Dame defensive lineman, like, grasping for him because he couldn't get to him in time. Yeah. That's just who he is as a quarterback and who he was in college. And so McQueen had to account for that during practice and how he'd, you know, call plays dead. So, like, he'd get an earful from the defensive coaches if he didn't call it dead. And then he'd get an earful from Caleb and Lincoln Riley if he was calling plays dead before they felt that it gave Caleb a chance to really do what he does well. So I thought that was kind of a funny one that shows, you know, he's damned if he does, damned if he doesn't. But it's, you know, those are the things that make him great as an athlete.
No, yeah. And I love in the Pivot podcast where he's like, listen, when it comes to, you know, statistics in the pocket, I'm one of the best there is. When it comes to statistics off schedule, I'm one of the best there is. So it doesn't lack confidence, absolutely doesn't lack doesn't have any doubts in his own ability. And I love that. I'm glad that as Chicagoans, we finally get a quarterback that feels that way about his own game. I mean, the last guy we had like that was Jay, but, like, it resulted in a lot of turnovers.
Yeah.
Like, Jay thought he could make every single throw and was going to look the DBs in the eye and go, I'm going to throw it. You just try and catch it. Yeah, I mean, so that that is the it's great to see a quarterback with confidence in the building. Appreciate you guys tuning in. Hit that like button, subscribe to the page, leave that 5-star review. Y'all know what to do. Let's keep this thing moving along, Courtney. We heard from Ryan Poles yesterday, and me and J-Mac kind of broke down some of the intricacies of the interview. I basically came out and said, listen, I thought Justin had a shot. He did not. That was my major takeaway from that interview. But what'd you hear yesterday that was kind of a major takeaway for you from what Ryan Poles talked about on the Pat McAfee show?
Couple things. Like, they weren't going to move off 9 when they were locked in on Roma Dunze. And no. that's consistent with everything that Poles has said after they made that draft pick. Beyond that, you know, I think it was Darius Butler had asked him about what's this offense going to look like. And that, unfortunately, is going to be the question that's brought up here. And you know you're not going to get an answer until we see how it actually looks in training camp. And then maybe you can start to put pieces together. But you're looking for the answer of, hey, you have all these weapons. How are you going to use them? Because this should be a pass-first offense. It should be. Like, you have 3 number one receivers in your offense. You have 2 very good tight ends. You have all of the tools to have a very good passing game with a quarterback who doesn't need insanely good pass protection. He just doesn't. And so you would imagine, and a lot of this is going to be like doing the homework for yourself to determine what's going to be the case and what's not without them telling you, yeah, we're a pass first offense. Eventually the numbers are going to tell you whether that's the case or not. Right. Cole said, you know, they said the PC thing, like, we want to be balanced. We think we want, you know, have more options to, you know, keep a defense on its toes and not make it obvious how they're going to beat you, how we're going to beat you. And that's cool. That's going to be the answer. It's the PC answer. It's the right answer right now, effectively. But, you know, that's a question that I knew was going to come up, and I'm not surprised that he didn't answer it. I think the punter stuff was interesting because he went on the Pat McAfee show the day that he released Torrey Taylor. Trenton Gill in favor of Torrey Taylor. And he explained that he wants to make teams uncomfortable, that, you know, being able to pin a team at the 10-yard line, you know, it is an intimidating place to be. And there are people who are going to listen to that and say, oh, well, the Bears, you know, averaged however many 5-6 punts a game last year or whatever. And was it really worth a 4th-round draft pick when you had other needs? And that's a fair question. But I thought that his answer to it at least shine some light. Like, that's a GM heat check to go you know, to go and draft a punter in the 4th round higher than they typically ever go. And to do it and like double down on like, no, this is going to make our football team better. It tells you that they think they're closer than maybe like they're letting that, at least maybe then like maybe we would have even thought, like,
absolutely.
Like, that should be a double digit win sort of indicator if you're using a 4th-round pick on a punter. But it's also like how the board fell, what other options. You and I talked about this on Tuesday. Like, there were really no other defensive end options available to them there. So it's like, do you try to trade back? Can you still get this punter in the 5th round? Their thought was no. And I think that they were just like viewing it in terms of, we can still get the defensive player we want, but we have to draft this punter first, just because the order of which, you know, might not have played out in their favor if they did it the other way.
Yeah, I thought the punter stuff was very interesting. And my God, I can't believe we're talking about a punter.
I know.
But I thought it was interesting because of what you said, right? When I see the move to go get the punter, fine. It is what it is. Would I have done it? No, I'm not a GM, right? I said trade for Chase Claypool. My record is not great. I did say Austin Booker, though, so let's hope I'm right. Maybe I'm 1 out of 2. Maybe I'm like Poles here. I get 1 out of 2. We both were wrong on Claypool. We get the second one right. But I think the thing for me is, I believe it does signal a move of like, no, listen, we plan on our defense being good enough that if we pin you inside the 10, you're done. Yeah. Right. Like, that's really what that's saying. It's not saying that, like, you know, we hope to get you there and then right, slow you down and you lose momentum as you go through. No, it's like, pin them inside the 10 and make sure that you're able to get this defense that already has some teeth and ability to kill teams inside the 10. That's a move to me that does signal like, hey, we think that we're going to be competing for a lot this year. Yeah. Not like we're just going to ease in the rookie quarterback. We're going to slowly get our bearings with this team. I think a Keenan Allen trade says that. I think the Trenton Gill, not releasing Trenton Gill, but
like getting a punter in the 4th round.
Getting a punter in the 4th round. Like, listen, Trenton Gill was released the second the card went in. Like, they just couldn't do it publicly that day. Like, I guarantee you he was on the phone with his agent seconds after that pick went in and was like, we looking for new work here, boys. But I really believe this signals to me that Ryan Poles looks at this team and says, this is a team that should get something done.
Yeah.
Bigger than what most people may think.
Yeah. And it's a move. It's usually like, those are sort of those like last piece sort of moves that you make when you're ready to contend. The rebuild is over. Now it's the next chapter. And even he said that, where he's ready to turn the page to the next chapter now that they got through a really difficult 2 years. And that's why, like, they've never would have made this pick a few years ago for obvious reasons. They had holes to fill elsewhere, and the picks that they made set them up to where those positions were addressed. And they didn't have to worry about that in this year's draft. But it will get criticized if the defensive line ends up like not being able to take a step forward in terms of sacks, quarterback pressures, QB hits, the whole thing. But I would like to believe that where they are right now, they'll double down on that every chance they get, that this will be their person who is quote unquote weapon. I'm curious to see how, like, and they're using weapon as field position, and controlling it is a weapon for us. Yeah. Cause that's going to give your offense more chances to be successful when you're having them start in, you know, in not always in plus territory, but at least beyond, like, you know, deep in opponent's territory, and having a situation where your defense is complementary of that too. And where are they getting stops? Like, that's important.
And we've kind of already heard, right? The one thing that everybody was like, oh, well, maybe he could be on kickoff. Like, that's kind of dead already, right? Like, he's not.
Like, kind of how they did that last year, or like with Trenton Gill and Cairo Santos, when they were both like in preseason games, one's kicking off. Yeah. I don't know. You paid Cairo Santos all that money. I think he's your kicker.
Yeah.
Safe bet.
Well, and listen, his leg's going to come in handy now. Like, Cairo Santos has been a guy who, like, I guess you can say maybe doesn't have the strongest leg in the world, but now it's like, hey, we need you to hit this 20-yard zone. He can do that. Yeah, I mean, we need you to make sure it lands here. Don't let it go into the end zone. Don't let it go here. We've seen many Cairo Santos kicks come up short. I think now is the perfect time to have Cairo back there kicking it, because it's going to come up right at the 1 yard line and teams are going to have to run it out. I love it. I can't believe we've spent this much time. Bears fans, we don't have to just argue. Y'all know that, right? We're looking for stuff to argue about now, Courtney. We're literally like, there's nothing left. Justin's gone. The Steelers are going to turn him into a kick returner, I guess. Now, I don't know what's going on with that, but like, now we got to find something new. Ah, let's hate on the punter. Like, kind of like, we don't have to argue about everything,
just
guys.
Because it's the outlier to the class, and one that's like really a punter in the fourth round. But like, you know, I'm not going to get mad at anybody either way. If you're upset about the pick, it's because you wish that they would have addressed other needs. If you're pumped about the pick, then you think, okay, this team's closer than maybe even I would have thought. So
yeah,
it's certainly one that deserves to be questioned, because specialists usually aren't taken that high, especially a freaking punter. But if it works out, then he's going to look like a genius. Like, that's just how this works.
I'll tell you one thing. If Caleb Williams, Rome Odunze, and who's the left tackle? Karan Amageji are all good. We will not pay attention to the punter.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
If somebody's beating their chest about the punter in the fourth round by the end of the season, that means something went wrong. That means we're punting a lot. I hope we barely see him. Like, give me three times a game at most. Caleb That's Williams the goal said, here.
Like, you don't have to punt much, which would be a great sign if the offense is just like scoring touchdowns every drive.
Yeah, we watched that Vikings game last year. A lot of punts. Don't need to see that ever again. Let's finish it off with this, Courtney. Appreciate y'all tuning in. Hit that like button if you have not done so. Subscribe to the page. Appreciate y'all for rocking with us, man. Make sure that you hit that notification bell as well. Stay locked in on everything that we've done here. Also, want to let you guys know, this episode is brought to you by the Hard Rock Casino in Northern Indiana. Las Vegas-style gaming, just 30 minutes from Soldier Field, exit 6, right off of I-80-94. That is a building that is already up and running and in place. And Courtney, it does not sound like the Chicago Bears will have the same kind of building. Governor Pritzker, who basically is has kind of scoffed at this whole thing the entire time.
Yeah.
The word used for this stadium is non-starter.
Yeah.
Are we getting a stadium at all? Like, what's going on
here? It'll eventually happen. I mean, they've got to. The lease at Soldier Field's up in, you know, I think 2033, so there still is time. But I think this is just kind of like they're getting into Kevin Warren and the Bears process right now. They're getting introduced to the process of Chicago and the state of Illinois in politics. Like, the fact that even before the meeting last week, the big reveal, the Manica, you know, the company designs a lot of these stadiums, their big renderings and seeing the green space and seeing the old columns of Soldier Field still standing with a bunch of like fields in there. And a lot of the ideas that were given out there, and then kind of getting cold water thrown on it. Like, even last week, like the J.B. Pritzker said that he was skeptical. And then this coming from the governor's office, whom his top aides met with the Bears team officials on Wednesday, said it's a non-starter. Well, right now it is. They did not rule it out completely. They said that they would, like, you know, keep the conversation open, but their whole idea, which is kind of the idea of a lot of cities and states and where this happens, is that taxpayer dollars funding stadiums, no matter what it is, no matter what the cost is, like, that it's not the best use of taxpayer money to do that. And there's been a lot of research done that publicly funded stadiums are typically not something that, you know, it's not a great investment for the public. Right. And so that's what the state of Illinois is saying right now, because this is a project. It's nearly $5 billion proposal. So it calls for $3.2 billion for the new stadium and then an additional $1.5 billion in infrastructure. Add that all up, that's $5 billion. And I know Brandon Johnson last week, the mayor of Chicago, said that there's no new taxes for Chicago residents. No, there's no tax hike either. But, like, I find it really hard to believe as a resident of Chicago. I'm just speaking for myself here.
Right.
Like, it's hard not to look at that and say that that's BS, because where is the money going to come from that plan then? Like, the 2% hotel tax, you can't force hotels to raise the price of rooms to cover that tax, where rooms are going to be $1,000 a night for anybody trying to stay in Chicago. Like, that's just, there's no way that they'd be able to get that through. So at least as of right now, it just feels like it's, the whole non-starter means come back to us with, it doesn't mean it's dead completely. It just means come back to us with a more realistic plan, because the Bears have committed $2 billion of their own private funding. And then there's the $900 million that's going to come from the NFL's loan program. There's what else is it? $300 million from the loan program, $900 million from the Illinois Sports Facility Authority, which, like, right, is the funding for that's a 2% tax, hotel tax. The state of Illinois is telling the Bears right now, this is not even, like, we're not even going to have a discussion when it's at this number. If you want to make it at Soldier Field, if you were dead set on doing it on the lakefront, you have to have that number come down. Otherwise, and it's funny, because I thought you and I had a good conversation about this the Tuesday before the draft, before this press conference, about, does this feel real? Does it feel like there's any change in plans, like, of them going back on Soldier Field? And it's like, okay, well, they look kind of silly if after all of this, and this is before we knew the figure, I said this, like, you know, it would look like a real bad about face if they ended up kind of like pivoting, going like a complete 180 on that and saying, oh man, like, all of a sudden we're just going to go back to Arlington. Well, if it continues like this, how could they not? And this is before we knew about, you know, a near $5 billion plan and what that would end up costing taxpayers. And I think one thing that, if you're, as Bears fans, as people who pay taxes, you have to, like, continue to, like, sift through the BS, because there's a lot of it, and politicians will always, you know, throw that stuff out there to try to sugarcoat things that, you know, they believe will then, like, get their way. There's a lot of hoops to jump through here. So again, it kind of feels like they're taking a step back. Like, okay, they've done their proposal. Like, you know, the PR machine that they had been using to pump this thing out didn't really work. It didn't change the perception of, oh, like, you know, getting people excited now to pay for a $5 billion stadium project. I don't think you'd ever find, you know, that to not be met with resistance.
Well, and I think the toughest part of all of it for me has been, I love the look of the stadium. I think it would be amazing. I would love to see it on the lakefront. I'm still confused on the parking, but, you know, I guess that's just a Chicago thing. They'll figure out where to park if they're able to get it done. But do you think that there was any part, especially with maybe the governor's office, any part of the press conference, any part of, right? Because that press conference was, it was interesting to say the least. It was distasteful in a lot of people around Illinois' mindset, to say the most, right? And I'm sugarcoating it based on a lot of what I've heard. I don't know if I was as offended as some people were about it, but it really did not sit well with a lot of people in the state of Illinois, how they went about that press conference. Do you think that that has any bearing on kind of this situation financially?
No, I think financially, like the numbers speak for themselves. Like, was the press conference over the top? And were there moments that were a little cringy? Sure. You can't control what people are going to say. And like, obviously, like the Bears can only control like what they say, like, and you know, how the thing was orchestrated. Like, yeah, there are a lot of people who are not thrilled that it started with an invocation. It kind of felt tone deaf. And I wasn't there because I was doing draft coverage up at Halas Hall all day for TV, but I watched it and I was like, okay, where are we going with this? Because you have to appear serious if you really think this is going to go through. And some of that stuff, like the mayor and a lot of the platitudes and the way in which he was speaking, make it come across like, you know, they were being like, it was a Hail Mary. And that
it felt like re-election. Like, I was like,
it felt very political. It felt like
a
campaign. And that's just, I'm telling you, that's going to turn, you're not going to win many people over when that's the case, unfortunately.
Yeah, this is, if we've learned anything from the NFL, NFL fans do not like mixing their politics and their football. I guess, I don't know, like, is there any way, I know it would look bad, but at this point, is there any way where Arlington has to come back into play? Not where the Bears want it to come back into play, but where it literally gets to a point where it's like, we've got the land, we have to build something, we have to.
You heard Karen Murphy say that every year they don't build this, it's like it's cost them $150 million more, I believe was the figure that she used. And that,
right.
That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money that they don't really, like, they really don't want to have to pay that. So you'd like to think sooner rather than later, they're going to end up just saying, all right, bite the bullet. It's either going to be the Bears taking on more money to get this thing done at Soldier Field, or them going back to Arlington where it can be a privately funded stadium where they own like the land, and maybe the concessions will, you know, now it's kind of like, well, the state of Illinois is saying, hell no, Arlington Heights may actually have more leverage because they don't have to be like, no, please come back. Like, if that's the Bears' only option, then who knows?
This is turned into such an interesting situation. This is why, right, when you deal with these, I guess the more political aspect of it and going through, right, the cities and different things like that, right, where I could have sworn Kevin Warren was in a position of, we've got the leverage, we're the Bears, bear down, here we go. And literally it feels like every other day it swings one way or the other. It swings. Nope, Illinois said no, you got no answers. Kevin Warren comes with an answer. The one thing that I do love is that Kevin Warren usually has an answer. Mm-hmm. So I love to see his answer
and
to this.
Yeah, but that's why I don't think it's completely dead in the water, but it's just that like they're going to have to come up with a workaround now, and he's going to have to be the one to lead them to that.
Well, there go the fields. No fields for the fans.
Where are they going to put the parking?
Like, although we could just, hear me out on this. Turn them into parking lots. Like, I get the fields. But I guarantee you, if the Bears are in the Super Bowl, fans will stand in the parking lot and watch the game. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't matter. Courtney, appreciate you tuning in with us for another episode. Anything else you want to leave the people with? Any nuggets that you haven't dropped on today's episode or in an article coming up?
No, I mean, it's going to be real interesting. 1 week from tonight is schedule release. How many primetime games this team gets? I'm putting the over-under right now at 5.
Ooh. You know what's crazy? I think I may have to take the over.
Yeah, it might be. It could very well be more.
There's too much that Ryan Poles has done. I think the Bears are going to be on the most national stage that we've ever seen them on, which scares the heck out of me. It means I'm going to be on a lot of late night post game shows. That'll be fun. It's not roofing in July. That's what I always tell myself. Hit that like button, subscribe to the page, leave a 5-star review. Y'all know what to do. Appreciate everybody tuning in and showing love. As always, for Courtney Cronin, I'm Pat the Designer, back at it again. As she said, schedule release on the way, and we got Yurko tomorrow. So please tune in, because it is going to be a joy for tomorrow's episode with all the punter talk that I will bring to him. Y'all stay safe out there. Peace.